Manchester for 17 years, but thought of himself as British to the bootstraps, and dreamed of retiring to a cottage in the English countryside, evidently happy to turn his back on his native soil forever. And poor old Harold Holt, whose fateful plunge into the sea in 1967 earned him my permanent devotion. It's quite a small club. Since 1901, Australia has had just 24 prime ministers, and I was startled to realize how many of them remained unfamiliar to me. Of the 24, I counted 14 of whom I knew essentially nothing, and 8, exactly one-third, of whom I had not even heard. These included the festively named Sir Earl Christmas Grafton Page, who was, to be fair, Prime Minister for less than a month in 1939, but also William McMahon, who held the office for almost 2 years in the early 1970s, and whose existence was until this moment quite unsuspected by me. I would have felt worse about this, except that only the day before I had read an article in the papers reporting a government study that had found that Australians themselves were essentially as ignorant of these men as I was. That indeed more people in Australia could identify and discuss the achievements of George Washington than could provide similar service for their own first elected head of state, Sir Edmund Barton. And with that sobering thought to ponder, I left the nation's capital and set off for distant Adelaide. Chapter 7. It is 800 miles from Canberra west to Adelaide, most of it along a lonely, half-forgotten road called the Sturt Highway. The highway was named for Captain Charles Sturt, who explored the region in a series of expeditions between 1828 and 1845. Apart from charting the languid course of the Murray River and its tributaries, Sturt's principal distinction was in being the first of the early explorers to show a measure of competence. He knew, for instance, to secure his horses at night. This might seem a self-evident requirement for anyone hundreds of miles into a desolate void, but it was a skill indifferently applied before him. John Oxley, the leader of a slightly earlier expedition, failed to keep his horses tethered and woke up one morning to find them all gone. He and his men spent 5 days, mostly on foot, rounding them all up. Soon after, the horses wandered off again. Nonetheless, Oxley is commemorated with a highway of his own in northern New South Wales. Australians are very generous in this respect. The Sturt Highway begins near Wagga Wagga, 100 miles or so west of Canberra, and crosses broad, flat, dust-brown sheep country known as the Riverina, an area of plains cut by the fidgety meanderings of the Murrumbidgee River. It provides a perfect demonstration in 3 dimensions of how swiftly you can be in the middle of nowhere in Australia. 1 minute I was in a comely world of paddocks, meadows, and pale green hills, with little country towns scattered at reliably accommodating intervals. And the next I was alone in an almost featureless nowhere, a disk of brown earth under a dome of blue sky, with only an occasional gum interposed between the two. Such habitations as I passed through weren't really communities at all, but just a couple of houses and a gas station, occasionally a pub, and eventually even they all but ceased. Between Narrandera, the last outpost of civilization, and Balranald, the next, lay 200 miles of highway without a town or hamlet on it. Every hour or so, I would pass a lonely roadhouse, a gas station with an attached cafe of the sort known in the happy vernacular of Australia as a chew and spew, and occasionally an earthen track bumping off to a distant, unseen sheep station. Otherwise, nothing. As if to emphasize the isolation, all the area radio stations began to abandon me. One by one their signals faltered, and all those smoky voices so integral to Australian airwaves. Vic Damone, Mel Torme, Frank Sinatra at the mindless height of his dooby-doo phase, faded away, as if being drawn by some heavy gravity back into the hole from which they had escaped. Eventually the radio dial presented only an uninterrupted cat's hiss of static, but for one clear spot near the end of the dial. At first I thought that's all it was, just an empty clear spot. But then I realized I could hear the faint shiftings and stirrings of seated people, and after quite a pause, a voice, calm and reflective, said, "Pilchard begins his long run in from short stump. He bowls, and, oh, he's out. Yes, he's got him. Long Willie is caught leg before in middle slops by Grattan. Well, now, what do you make of that, Neville?" "That's definitely one for the books, Bruce. I don't think I've seen offside, medium-slow, fast-paced bowling to match it since Baden Powell took Ranga Changa Banga for a maiden ovary at Bangalore in 1948. I had stumbled into the surreal and rewarding world of cricket on the radio. After years of patient study, and with cricket there can be no other kind, I have decided that there is nothing wrong with the game that the introduction of golf carts wouldn't fix in a hurry. It is not true that the English invented cricket as a way of making all other human endeavors look interesting and lively. That was merely an unintended side effect. I don't wish to denigrate a sport that is enjoyed by millions, some of them awake and facing the right way, but it is an odd game. It is the only sport that incorporates meal breaks. It is the only sport that shares its name with an insect. It is the only sport in which spectators burn as many calories as players, more if they are moderately restless. It is the only competitive activity of any type, other than perhaps baking, in which you can dress in white from head to toe and be as clean at the end of the day as you were at the beginning. Imagine a form of baseball in which the pitcher, after each delivery, collects the ball from the catcher and walks slowly with it out to center field, and that there, after a minute's pause to collect himself, he turns and runs full tilt towards the pitcher's mound, before hurling the ball at the ankles of a man who stands before him, wearing a riding hat, heavy gloves of the sort used to handle radioactive isotopes, and a mattress strapped to each leg. Imagine, moreover, that if this batsman fails to hit the ball in a way that heartens him sufficiently to try to waddle 40 feet with mattresses strapped to his legs, he is under no formal compunction to run. He may stand there all day, and, as a rule, does. If by some miracle he is coaxed into making a misstroke that leads to his being put out, all the fielders throw up their arms in triumph and have a hug. Then tea is called, and everyone retires happily to a distant pavilion to fortify for the next siege. Now imagine all this going on for so long that by the time the match concludes, autumn has crept in and all your library books are overdue. There you have cricket. But it must be said there is something incomparably soothing about cricket on the radio. It has much the same virtues as baseball on the radio. An unhurried pace, a comforting devotion to abstruse statistics and thoughtful historical rumination, exhilarating micro-moments of real action, but stretched across many more hours, and with a lushness of terminology and restful elegance of expression that even baseball cannot match. Listening to cricket on the radio is like listening to two men sitting in a rowboat on a large, placid lake on a day when the fish aren't biting. It's like having a nap without losing consciousness. It actually helps not to know quite what's going on. In such a rarefied world of contentment and inactivity, comprehension would become a distraction. So, here comes Stovepipe to bowl on this glorious summer's afternoon at the Melbourne Cricket Ground, one of the commentators was saying now. I wonder if he'll chance an offside drop scone here, or go for the quick leg over. Stovepipe has an unusual delivery in that he actually leaves the grounds and starts his run just outside the Carlton and United Brewery at Kooyong. That's right, Clive. I haven't known anyone start his delivery that far back since Stopcock caught his sleeve on the reversing mirror of a number 11 bus during the third test at Brisbane in 1957, and ended up at Goondiwindi 4 days later, owing to some frightful confusion over a changed timetable at Toowoomba Junction. After a very long silence while they absorbed this thought, and possibly stepped out to transact some small errands, they resumed with a leisurely discussion of the England fielding. Neasden, it appeared, was turning in a solid performance at square bowl, while Packett had been a stalwart in the dribbles. Though even these exemplary performances paled when set aside the outstanding play of young Hugh Twain Buttocks at middle nipple. The commentators were in calm agreement that they'd not seen anyone caught behind with such panache since Tandoori took Rogan Josh for a stiffy at Vindaloo in 61. At last, Stovepipe, having found his way over the railway line at Flinders Street, the footbridge was evidently closed for painting, returned to the stadium and bowled to Hasty, who deftly turned the ball away for a corner. This was repeated 4 times more over the next 2 hours, and then one of the commentators pronounced, "So, as we break for second luncheon, and with 11,200 balls remaining, Australia are 962 for 2 not half, and England are 4 for a duck, and hoping for rain." I may not have all the terminology exactly right, but I believe I've caught the flavour of it. The upshot was that Australia was giving England a good thumping, but then Australia pretty generally does. In fact, Australia pretty generally beats most people at most things. Truly, never has there been a more sporting nation. At the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, to take just one random but illustrative example, Australia, the 52nd largest nation in the world, brought home more medals than all but four other countries, all of them much larger. The countries, not the medals. Measured by population, its performance was streets ahead of anyone else. Australians won 3.78 medals per million of population, a rate more than 2.5 times better than the next best performer, Germany, and almost 5 times the rate of the United States. Moreover, Australia's medal-winning tally was distributed across a range of sports, 14, matched by only one other nation, the United States. Hardly a sport exists at which the Australians do not excel. Do you know, there are even 40 Australians playing baseball at the professional level in the United States, including 5 in the major leagues, and Australians don't even play baseball, at least not in any particularly devoted manner. They do all this on the world stage and play their own games as well, notably a very popular form of loosely contained mayhem called Australian rules football. It is a wonder in such a vigorous and active society that there is anyone left to form an audience. No, the mystery of cricket is not that Australians play it well, but that they play it at all. It has always seemed to me a game much too restrained for the rough-and-tumble Australian temperament. Australians much prefer games in which brawny men in scanty clothing bloody each other's noses. I'm quite certain that if the rest of the world vanished overnight, and the development of cricket was left in Australian hands, within a generation the players would be wearing shorts and using the bats to hit each other. And the thing is, it would be a much better game for it. In the late afternoon, while the players broke for high tea or fifth snack or something, in any case when the activity on the field went from very slight to non-existent, I stopped at a roadhouse for gas and coffee. I studied my book of maps and determined that I would stop for the night in Hay, a modest splat in the desert a little off the highway a couple of hours down the road. As it was the only community in a space of 200 miles, this was not a particularly taxing decision. Then, having nothing better to do, I leafed through the index and amused myself, in a very low-key way, by looking for ridiculous names, of which Australia has a respectable plentitude. I am thus able to report that the following are all real places. Weewa, Poowong, Burram Buttock, Suggan Buggan, Booma Namuna, Wai, Mullumbimby, Jigalong, and the supremely satisfying Tittybong. As I paid, the man asked me where I was headed. "Hey," I replied, and was struck by a sudden droll thought. "And I'd better hurry. Do you know why?" He gave me a blank look. "Because I want to make hay while the sun shines," I said. The man's expression did not change. "I want to make hay while the sun shines," I repeated with a slight alteration of emphasis and a more encouraging expression. The blank look, I realized after a moment, was probably permanent. "Oh, you won't have any trouble with that," the man said after a minute's considered thought. "It'll be light for hours yet." Hay was a hot and dusty but surprisingly likable little town off the Stuart Highway across an old bridge over the muddy Murrumbidgee. In the motel I dumped my bag and reflexively switched on the TV. It came up on the cricket, and I sat on the foot of the bed and watched it with unwonted absorption for some minutes. Needless to say, very little was happening on the field. An official in a white coat was chasing after a blown piece of paper, and several of the players were examining the ground by the stumps, evidently looking for something. I couldn't think what, but then one of the commentators noticed that England had just lost a wicket, so I supposed it was that. After a time, a lanky young man in the outfield, who had been polishing a ball on his pant leg as if about to take a bite from it, broke into a loping run. At length he hurled the ball at the distant batter, who insouciantly lifted his bat an inch from the ground and putted it back to him. These motions were scrupulously replicated 3 times more. Then the commentator said, "And so at the end of the 452nd over, as we break for afternoon nap, England have increased their total to 17. So still quite a lot of work for them to do if they're going to catch Australia before fourth snack." I went out for a stroll over the terrestrial hot plate that is inland New South Wales in summer. The day was extravagantly warm. Every leaf on the curbside trees was limp, like a tongue hanging out. I wandered up and down both sides of Lachlan Street, the main drag, and then some way out into the country to enjoy the sunset, an event always of calm and golden glory in the bush, and in the hope, ever unfulfilled, of seeing some kangaroos hopping picturesquely into frame. Kangaroos are commoner in Australia now than they were before Europeans came, because all the rural improvements, the encouragement of grassland, the creating of ponds, and so on, has benefited them in the same way it has sheep and cattle. Nobody knows how many kangaroos the country holds, but the number is generally assumed to be over 100 million, making them not much less numerous than sheep. But could I find even one out here? I could not. So I strolled back into town and passed the evening in my usual gracious style. Lager cocktails in a forlorn and nearly empty pub, dinner of steak and salad in a restaurant next door, another stroll to the edge of town to look, in vain, for kangaroos by moonlight. I was back in my room by about 9:30. I switched on the TV and was impressed to see that play was still going on in the cricket match. Give the men their due. It may be light work, but they put in the hours. The man in the white coat was still chasing paper, though it wasn't possible to tell if it was the same piece. England, according to the commentator, had lost another 3 wickets, which seemed rather absent-minded of them. At this rate, they would soon run out of equipment altogether and have to call it a day. Perhaps, I decided as I switched the TV off, that was what they were hoping for. In the morning, I treated myself to a big breakfast, to fortify myself for another long day's drive. Breakfast is, of course, our most savage event in Western society. If you hesitate to agree, then I urge you to name me another occasion, any occasion at all, when you would happily devour an embryo. And Australians seem to have a good fix on this. A lot of it comes down to a mastery of bacon. Unlike the curled shoe tongues that are consumed in Britain, or the boringly crisp, regimented strips we go for in America, Australian bacon has a rough, meaty, fair-dinkum hardiness. It looks as if it was taken off the pig while it was trying to escape. You can almost hear the squeal in every bite. Lovely. Also, they cut their toast thick. In short, the Australians know what they are about with breakfasts. And so, radiant with cholesterol and contentment, I returned to the lonesome road. Beyond hay, the landscape was even more impossibly flat, brown, empty, and dull. The monumental emptiness of Australia is not easy to convey. It is far and away the most thinly peopled of nations. In Britain, the average population density is 632 people per square mile. In the United States, the average is 76. Across the world as a whole, it is 117. And, just for interest, in Macau, the record holder, it is a decidedly snug 69,000 people per square mile. The Australian average, by contrast, is 6 people per square mile. But even that modest figure is wildly skewed, because, of course, Australians overwhelmingly live in a few clustered spots along the coast, and leave the rest of the country undisturbed. Indeed, the proportion of people in Australia who live in urban areas is, at 86%, about as high as in Holland, and nearly as high as in Hong Kong. Out here, if you found 6 people occupying the same square mile, it would be either a family reunion or an Aum Shinrikyo planning session. From time to time I pass through long miles of mallee scrub, low shrubs just bushy enough and high enough to strangle any view, and very occasionally, in the open plains, I would spy a low line of vivid green on the right-hand horizon, which I presumed marked an irrigated zone along the Murrumbidgee. Otherwise nothing, just hard earth that strained to support a little dry grass, and the odd thorny acacia or bent eucalypt. It wasn't always so. Although inland Australia has never been exactly verdant, much of the marginal land once experienced periods of relative lushness, sometimes lasting years, occasionally lasting decades, and it enjoyed a natural resiliency that let it spring back after droughts. Then in 1859, a man named Thomas Austin, a landowner in Winchelsea, Victoria, a little south of where I was now, made a big mistake. He imported 24 wild rabbits from England and released them into the bush for sport. It is hardly a novel observation that rabbits breed with a certain keenness. Within a couple of years they had entirely overrun Austin's property and were spreading into neighbouring districts. 50 million years of isolation had left Australia without a single predator or parasite able even to recognise rabbits, much less dine off them, and so they proliferated amazingly. Collectively, their appetite was essentially insatiable. By 1880, 2 million acres of Victoria had been picked clean. Soon they were pushing into South Australia and New South Wales, advancing over the landscape at a rate of 75 miles per year. Until the rabbits came, much of the countryside where I was driving now was characterized by lush groves of Eremophila, a shrub that grew to a height of about 7 feet and was in flower for most of the year. It was, by all accounts, a beauty, and its leaves a boon to nibbling creatures. But rabbits fell on the Eremophila like locusts, devouring every bit of them, leaves, flowers, bark, stems, until none were to be found. The rabbits ate so much of everything that sheep and other livestock were forced to extend both their range and their diet, punishing yet wider expanses. As sheep yields fell, farmers perversely compensated by increasing stocking levels, adding to the general devastation. The problem would have been acute enough, but in the 1890s, after 40 unusually green years, Australia fell into a murderous decade-long drought, the worst in its recorded history. As the earth cracked and turned to dust, the topsoil, already the thinnest in the world, blew away, never to be replenished. In the course of the decade, some 35 million sheep, more than half the nation's total, perished. 16 million went in a single pitiless year, 1902. The rabbits, meanwhile, hopped on. By the time science finally came up with a solution, almost a century had passed since Thomas Austin tipped his 24 bunnies out of the bag. The weapon deployed against the rabbits was a miracle virus from South America called myxomatosis. Harmless to humans and other animals, it was phenomenally devastating to rabbits, with a mortality rate of 99.9%. Almost at once, the countryside filled with twitching, stumbling, very sick rabbits, and then with tens of millions of little corpses. Although just one rabbit in 1,000 survived, those few that did were naturally resistant to myxomatosis, and it was resistant genes that they passed on when they began to breed again. It took a while for things to get rolling, but today Australia's rabbit numbers are back up to 300 million and climbing fast. At all events, the damage to the landscape, much of it permanent and irreversible, had already been done. And also some clown could have something to pot at from his veranda. Just as you plunge into emptiness with startling abruptness in Australia, so you plunge out of it again. Shortly after crossing into South Australia in mid-afternoon, I found myself entering rolling hills of orange groves. It was so startling I got out and had a look. On one side stretched arid emptiness, a plain of burlap spattered with clumps of mallee. But before me, filling the view to the distant horizon, spread a biblical-looking promised land. Citrus groves and vineyards and vegetable patches in every lush shade of green. As I pushed on, the balance between orchards and vineyards tipped increasingly in favor of the latter, until eventually there was nothing but vineyards, and I realized I had reached the Barossa Valley, a quite spectacularly pretty corner of Australia, with rolling hills of abundant green that gave it, literally and metaphorically, a Mediterranean air. It was mostly settled by German farmers, who started Australia's wine industry here. Today Australians are among the most wine-savvy people on earth, but that development is quite recent. A story often recounted is how the British wine expert Len Evans, on a visit to the country in the 1950s, asked for a glass of wine in a country hotel. The hotelier regarded him narrowly for a long moment and asked, "What are you, some kind of puff?" Even now the wines for which the Barossa is celebrated, Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Shiraz, are all recent arrivals. Into the 1980s, the government was paying growers to uproot Shiraz vines and produce sticky, sweet Rieslings. I've never quite understood why tourists from the more prosperous end of the market are so drawn to wine-growing areas. They wouldn't, presumably, want to go and see cotton before it became L.L. Bean slacks, or caviar being gutted from sturgeon, but give them a backdrop of vines, and they appear to think they have found heaven. Having said that, the Barossa Valley is awfully appealing, particularly after a couple of days on the lonely and far-flung Stuart Highway. I stopped for the night in Tanunda, a handsome and well-touristed little town, mostly built along one very long street, fetchingly shadowed with leafy trees. Given its popularity with tourists and its Germanic beginnings, I had rather feared that Tanunda would be themed accordingly, but apart from one or two restaurants with house in their titles, and the odd mention of Wurst in shop windows, there was mercifully little attempt to exploit its heritage. It was the eve of Australia Day, the big national holiday, and Tanunda was busy with people who had come for a mini-break. I found a room, not without some difficulty, then wandered to the main street for a stroll before dinner. It was crowded with people who, like me, were trying to fill that empty hour between the shops closing and the moment when one might with propriety start to drink. I walked among them, happy to be back in civilization, happy, above all, to be able to eavesdrop on conversations that didn't involve sheep dip, temperamental machinery, new wells, or land clearance, or rumps, sumps, pumps, and stumps, as I had begun to think of it. It was clear from the conversations that I had landed in Yuppieville. Most were engaged in the interesting middle-class pastime of identifying all the objects in shop windows that looked like objects belonging to people they knew. Wherever I lingered, I could hear someone observing, "Oh, look, Sarah's got a bowl just like that," or, "Your mother used to have a tea service like that one. I wonder whatever became of it. You don't suppose she gave it to Samantha, do you?" A few couples were playing a slightly edgier version of this game, which involved supplementary comments like, "No, the one you broke was much nicer," and, "But how many pairs of pearl earrings do you need, for God's sake?" And, "Well, if she did give it to Samantha, I'm going to be extremely pissed off, frankly, because she promised it to me. You'll just have to have a word with her." These were the people, I guessed, who had driven the farthest to get here and most needed a drink, or possibly were just assholes. I liked Tanunda and had a very pleasant evening there, but there was absolutely nothing exceptional or eventful in the experience, so I'm going to tell you instead a little story related to me by a lovely woman named Catherine Veitch. Catherine Veitch was my oldest friend in Australia, both in the sense that she was my first chum there, and also that she was just about old enough to be my mother. I met her at the Melbourne Writers' Festival in 1992. I can't remember the circumstances now, other than that she approached me after a reading, either to set me straight with regard to some mistake I had made in one of my books on language, she was of a scholarly bent and impatient with sloppiness, or to enlighten me concerning some aspect of Australian life on which I had imprudently commented in the question-and-answer session. The upshot is that we had a cup of tea in the cafeteria, and that the next day I took a tram to her house in St. Kilda for lunch, where I met most of her family. Her children, of whom she seemed to have a large but indeterminate number, were all grown and living away, but most of them called in at various points in the afternoon, to borrow a tool or check for messages, or to burrow in the fridge. It was just the kind of household I had always longed to grow up in. Happy, comfortable, nicely chaotic, full of shouted conversations of the "try looking in the cupboard at the top of the stairs" type. And I liked Catherine very much. She was kind and funny and thoughtful and direct. So we became great friends, though it was a friendship based almost entirely on correspondence. She had never been to America, and I went to Australia once a year if I was lucky, and not always to Melbourne. But three or four times a year she would send me long, wonderfully discursive letters hammered out on a jumpy and willful typewriter. These letters seldom took less than an hour to read. In a single page they could range over a galaxy of subjects. Her childhood in Adelaide, the inadequacies of certain politicians, actually of most politicians, why Australians lack confidence, what her children had been up to. Generally she stuck in a wadding of cuttings from The Age, the Melbourne newspaper. Much of what I know about Australia I learned from her. I loved those letters. They came from so far away. Just getting an envelope from Australia still seemed to me a faintly wondrous event, and described events and experiences that were unexceptional to her, but breathtakingly exotic to me. Taking a tram into the city, suffering through a heat wave in December, attending a lecture at the Royal Melbourne Institute, shopping for curtains at David Jones, the big local department store. I can't explain it except to say that, without giving up any part of the life I had already, I wanted intensely to have all that in my life as well. So it was through her letters, more than from almost anything else, that I consolidated my fixation with Australia. Her letters were always happy, but the last one I received from her was especially sunny. She and John, her husband, were about to sell the house in St. Kilda and move to the Mornington Peninsula, south of Melbourne, to take up a life of gracious retirement beside the sea, fulfilling a dream of very long standing. Just after she sent that letter, to the shock of everyone who knew her, she suffered a sudden heart attack and died. I'd have been on my way to visit her now. Instead, all I can offer is my favorite of the many stories she told me. In the 1950s, a friend of Catherine's moved with her young family into a house next door to a vacant lot. One day, a construction crew turned up to build a house on the lot. Catherine's friend had a 3-year-old daughter, who naturally took an interest in all the activity going on next door. She hung around on the margins, and eventually the construction workers adopted her as a kind of mascot. They chatted to her and gave her little jobs to do, and at the end of the week presented her with a little pay packet containing a shiny new half-crown. She took this home to her mother, who made all the appropriate cooings of admiration, and suggested that they take it to the bank the next morning to deposit it in her account. When they went to the bank, the cashier was equally impressed and asked the little girl how she'd come by her own pay packet. "I've been building a house this week," she replied proudly. "Goodness," said the teller. "And will you be building a house next week, too?" "I will if we ever get the fucking bricks," answered the little girl. Chapter 8 South Australians are very proud that theirs is the only Australian state that never received convicts. What they don't often mention is that it was planned by one. In the early 1830s, Edward Gibbon Wakefield, a man of independent means and unsavory inclinations, was in Newgate Prison in London on a charge of abducting a female child for sweaty and nefarious purposes when he hatched the idea to found a colony of freemen in Australia. His plan was to sell parcels of land to sober, industrious people, farmers and capitalists, and use the funds raised to pay the passage of laborers to work for them. The laborers would gain ennobling employment, the investors would acquire a workforce and a market, everyone would benefit. The scheme never worked terribly well in practice, but the result was a new colony, South Australia, and a delightful planned city, Adelaide. Whereas Canberra is a park, Adelaide is merely full of them. In Canberra, you have the sense of being in a very large green space you cannot ever quite find your way out of. In Adelaide, you are indubitably in a city, but with the constant pleasant option of stepping out of it from time to time to get a breath of air in a spacious green setting. Makes all the difference. The city was laid out as two distinct halves, facing each other across the green plain of the Torrens River, with each half fully enclosed by parks. On a map, therefore, central Adelaide forms a large, plump, somewhat irregular figure 8, with parks creating the figure and the two inner halves of the city filling the holes. It works awfully well. I had no special destination in mind, but the next morning, as I drove into the city from Tanunda, I passed through North Adelaide, the handsome and prosperous zone inside the top half of the figure 8, spotted an agreeable-looking hotel, and impetuously threw the car at the curb. I was on O'Connell Street, in a neighborhood of old, well-preserved buildings, with lots of trendy-looking restaurants, pubs, and cafes. After Canberra, I wasn't going to let a slice of urban heaven like this slip past. So I procured a room, and lost not a moment getting back into the open air. Adelaide is the most overlooked of Australia's principal cities. You could spend weeks in Australia and never suspect it was there, for it rarely makes the news or gets a mention in anyone's conversation. It is to Australia essentially what Australia is to the world, a place pleasantly regarded, but far away and seldom thought about. And yet it is unquestionably a lovely city. Everyone has agreed on that, including millions who have never been there. I had been just once myself, on a book tour a few months before. What remained from that experience was an impression of physical handsomeness, coupled with an oddly pleased sense of doom on the part of the inhabitants. Remark to anyone in Adelaide what an agreeable place it is, and you will be told at once, with a kind of eager solemnity, "Yes, but it's dying, you know." "Is it?" you say, in a tone of polite concern. "Oh, yes," confides your informant, nodding with grim satisfaction. Then, if you are very unlucky, the person will tell you all about the collapse of the Bank of South Australia, an event of fiscal carelessness that took years to conclude and is nearly as long in the telling. Adelaide's problem, it appears, is geographical. The city stands on the wrong edge of civilized Australia, far from the vital Asian markets, and with nothing on its own doorstep but a great deal of nothing. To the north and west lie a million odd square miles of serene desert. To the south, nothing but open sea all the way to Antarctica. Only to the east are there any cities, but even Melbourne is 450 miles away, and Sydney nearer 1,000. Why would anyone build a factory in Adelaide when it is so far from its markets? It is a reasonable question, but somewhat undermined by the consideration that Perth is even more remote, 1,700 miles more remote in its lonely outpost on the Indian Ocean, yet has a far more vibrant economy. At all events, the bottom line is that Adelaide seems stuck in an unhappy place in every sense of the word. Yet to the casual observer, it seems quite as affluent as any other big city in Australia, possibly even more so. Its central shopping district is better looking and at least as well used as the equivalent zones in Sydney or Melbourne, and its pubs, restaurants, and cafes appear to be as bustling and lively as any entrepreneur could wish. It has an outstanding stock of Victorian buildings, an abundance of parks and comely squares, and constant small touches, an ornate lamppost here, a stone lion there, that give it a dash of classiness and respectful venerability that Sydney and Melbourne all too often discarded for the sequin glitter of skyscrapers. It feels rather like an urban version of a gentleman's club. Comfortable, old-fashioned, quietly grand, slightly drowsy by mid-afternoon, redolent of another age. As I strolled downhill along Pennington Gardens, one of the central parks, I became gradually, and then overwhelmingly, aware of the tide of human activity all moving in a single direction. Thousands and thousands of people converging on a stadium in the park. I asked two young men what was going on, and was told there was a cricket match between England and Australia at the Oval. "What, here in Adelaide, today?" I said in surprise. He considered the question with the bemusement it merited. "Well, either that," he replied dryly, "or 30,000 people have made one pretty amazing bloody mistake, wouldn't you say?" Then he smiled to show that he wasn't being aggressive or anything. It appeared that he and his partner had stopped for a gallon or two of refreshment en route. "Do you know, are there still tickets left?" I asked. "Nah, mate, sold out, sorry." I nodded and watched them go. That was another very British thing about Australians I'd noticed. They apologized for things that weren't their fault. I found my way along North Terrace, the city's grandest thoroughfare, to the South Australian Museum, a stately pile devoted to natural and anthropological history. I was interested to see if it displayed a fossil called Spriggina, named for a minor hero of mine called Reginald Sprigg. In 1946, Sprigg, then a young government geologist, was poking around in the blisteringly inhospitable Ediacaran Hills of the Flinders Ranges, some 300 miles north of Adelaide, when he made one of those miraculous discoveries in which Australian natural history almost impossibly abounds. You will recall the case of the strange and long-lost proto-ant Nothomyrmecia macrops, found unexpectedly at a dusty hamlet in the middle of nowhere. Well, Sprigg's find was in much the same general area, and, in its way, no less remarkable. His special moment came when he clambered a few yards up a rocky slope to find a piece of shade and a comfortable rock to lean against to have his lunch. As he sat eating his sandwiches, he idly stretched out a toe and turned over a hunk of sandstone. Sprigg left no informal account of the event, but I think we can safely imagine him pausing in his chewing, pausing for a long moment, mouth slightly open, to stare at what he had just turned over, then slowly creeping nearer to have a closer look. What he had just found, you see, was something that wasn't thought to exist. For almost a century, since the time of Charles Darwin, scientists have been puzzled by an evolutionary anomaly. That 600 million years ago, complex life forms of an improbable variety had suddenly burst forth on Earth, the famous Cambrian explosion, but without any evidence of earlier, simpler forms that might have paved the way for such an event. Sprigg had just found that missing link, a piece of rock swimming in delicate Precambrian fossils. He was looking, in effect, at the dawn of visible life, at something no one had ever seen before, or ever expected to see. It was a moment of supreme geological significance, and if he had sat anywhere else, anywhere at all in the infinite baking expanse that is the Australian outback, it would not have been made. Certainly not then, possibly not ever. That's the thing about Australia, you see. It teems with interesting stuff, but but at the same time it's so vast and empty and forbidding that it generally takes a remarkable stroke of luck to find it. Unfortunately, in 1946 the world scientific community paid little heed to news from Australia, and Spriggs' reports of his findings, duly recorded in the Transactions of the Royal Society of South Australia, languished for 2 decades before their significance became generally appreciated. But never mind. In the end, credit fell where it was due. Sprigg was immortalized with the name of a fossil, and the epoch he uncovered became known as the Ediacaran, after the hills through which he had tramped. Alas, the museum was not open when I passed by. Closed for the national holiday, I supposed, and so my hopes of glimpsing the dawn of life were dashed. Wandering on through shady side streets, however, I found a second-hand bookshop open, and was happy to take that as a consolation prize. Probably because new books have always been expensive in Australia, the country has outstanding second-hand bookshops. These always have a large section devoted to Australiana, and these sections never fail to amaze, if only because they show you what a remarkably self-absorbed people the Australians are. I don't mean that as a criticism. If the rest of the world is going to pay them no attention, then they must do it themselves, surely. That seems fair enough to me. But you do find in any trawl through the jumbled stacks the most wondrous titles. One of the first I took down now was called That's Where I Met My Wife, a story of the first swimming pool in the national capital at Canberra. Nearby was a plump volume entitled A Sense of Union, a History of Sydney University Football Club. Beside that was a history of the South Australia Ambulance Service. There were hundreds of titles like this, books about things that could never possibly have been of interest to more than a handful of people. It's quite encouraging that these books exist, but somehow faintly worrying as well. Among them, however, you will often find the most rewarding surprises. This was so now when I took down a photographic history of Surfer's Paradise, the famous Queensland beach resort, which caught my eye because I was heading there shortly. The book covered the story of the resort's development from the 1920s, when it was a fly-blown coastal hamlet of neither fame nor consequence, to the early 1970s, when it abruptly burst forth as a kind of Miami Beach of the Southern Hemisphere. What particularly captivated me were the photographs of it during its intermediate phase, in the 1940s and 50s, when it was much closer in spirit and appearance to Coney Island or Blackpool. It is odd to be filled with a nostalgic longing for a place you have never known, but I was with Surfer's Paradise and its innocent vacationers. I gazed enraptured at page after page of crisp black-and-white photographs showing happy people at play, strolling in happy groups along the esplanade, jitterbugging in dance halls, sitting with drinks at surfside bars. How I envied them their snazzy outfits. I realize I may be in a minority here, but I would give almost anything to live in an age when I could put on two-toned shoes, red socks, a lively cotton shirt with a repeating pattern based on, say, baggage labels, hoist my baggy brown pants to just level with my nipples, drop a felt hat on my head, and have people walking past look at me twice and think, "Stylish guy." There was something so marvelously innocent, so irretrievably lost about the world back then. You could see it in the easy, confident gait and sun-drenched smile of the vacationers in every photograph. These people were happy. I don't mean they were happy. They were happy. They were living at a good time in a lucky country, and they knew it. They had good jobs, good homes, good families, good prospects, good vacations in cheerful, sunny places. I wouldn't suggest for an instant that Australians are unhappy people now. Anything but, in fact. But they don't have that happiness in their faces anymore. I don't think anybody does. It was, it must be said, an age of the most dazzling primness. In the 1950s, Australia was probably the least confident nation in the English-speaking world. It was so far from everywhere that the authorities didn't seem to know quite what was acceptable. So essentially they played it safe and allowed nothing. One of the photographs in the Surfer's Paradise book showed a souvenir emporium that had a very large billboard on its roof. The ad on the billboard was the famous Coppertone suntan lotion ad, in which a small girl is having her bikini bottom pulled down by an impish puppy, exposing an inch or two of sweet little bottom. And here's the thing. Someone had gotten out a ladder, climbed up with a bucket of paint, and carefully painted panties over the little girl's crack. Well, can't have people masturbating on the esplanade, after all. It wasn't just suntan lotion ads that were censored, but movies, plays, magazines, and books in numbers unbelievable. One thing you won't find much in second-hand Australian bookshops is 1950s or earlier editions of lots of books. Catcher in the Rye, A Farewell to Arms, Animal Farm, Peyton Place, Another Country, Brave New World, and hundreds of others. The reason for this is simple. They were banned. Altogether, at its peak, 5,000 titles were forbidden to be imported into the country. By the 1950s, this had fallen to a couple of hundred, but it still included some extraordinary exclusions. Childbirth Without Pain, for instance, whose unflinching candor in describing where babies come from was considered a little too rich for Australian sensibilities. This was just conventional titles, by the way. The total doesn't include smutty stuff, which was, of course, banned outright. It wasn't just that you couldn't get certain books. You couldn't even find out which ones you couldn't get, because the list of prescribed books was itself a secret. It was Adelaide, interestingly, that put an end to all this. For decades, it had been one of the more arrestingly unprogressive of Australian cities. The blame for this can be dropped in the lap of one Sir Thomas Playford, who for 38 years, from the 1930s to the 1960s, was South Australia's premier or governor. Playford was a man so parochial that once, during a commodities crisis, he suggested that the state might have to import wheat from Australia, and on another occasion remarked to the vice-chancellor of the University of Adelaide that he couldn't see any point in universities at all. As you can imagine, he did not notably enrich the intellectual vigor of South Australia. Then in 1968, the state elected a youthful and charismatic Labour premier named Don Dunstan, and almost at once Adelaide and South Australia underwent a transformation. The city became a haven for artists and intellectuals. The Adelaide Festival blossomed into the nation's preeminent cultural event. Books that were still banned elsewhere in Australia, Portnoy's Complaint and Naked Lunch, for example, were freely available in Adelaide. Nude bathing beaches were allowed. Homosexuality was legalized. For one giddy decade or so, Adelaide was the hippest city in the country, the San Francisco of the Antipodes. In 1979, Dunstan's wife died, and he abruptly retired from politics. Adelaide lost its momentum and began a gentle descent into obscurity. The artists and intellectuals drifted away. Even Dunstan moved to Victoria. Under Playford, South Australia had been backward, but interestingly so. Under Dunstan, it was racy and exhilaratingly so. The real problem with Adelaide these days, I suspect, is that it has just stopped being interesting. Still, it's a lovely place for an amble on a summer's day. I made a couple of small purchases in the bookshop, an old hardback called Australian Paradox, which I bought for no more solid reason than that I rather liked the cover, and it was attractively priced at $2, and a more recent volume entitled Crocodile Attack in Australia, which was nearly 10 times dearer, but had the compensating virtue of containing a great many gruesome anecdotes, then wandered off for a hike through the city's green and commodious parks. Central Adelaide boasts almost 1,800 acres of parks, less than Canberra, but a great deal more than most other cities of its size. As so often in Australia, they reflect an effort to recreate a familiarly British ambience in an Antipodean setting. Of all the things people longed for when they first came to Australia, an English backdrop was perhaps the most outstanding. It is notable, when you look at early paintings of the country, how awkward, how strikingly un-Australian, the landscape so often appears. Even the gum trees look unusually lush and globular, as if the artists were willing them to take on a more English aspect. Australia was a disappointment to the early settlers. They ached for English air and English vistas. So when they built their cities, they laid them out with rolling English-style parks, plumply arrayed with stands of oak, beech, chestnut, and elm, in a way that recalled the dreamily bucolic efforts of Humphrey Repton or Capability Brown. Adelaide is the driest city in the driest state in the driest continent, but you would never guess it from wandering through its parks. Here it is forever Sussex. Unfortunately, such arrangements are out of fashion in the horticultural world. Since many of the original plantings are now coming to the end of their natural lives, the park authorities have instituted plans to sweep away the intruder species and recreate a riverine landscape dominated by mallee scrub and Red River gums of the sort that existed here naturally before Europeans came along. Heartwarming though it is to see Australians taking pride in their native flora, the plan seems unfortunate, to say the least. To begin with, Australia has several hundred thousand square miles of landscape featuring mallee scrub and Red River gums. It is not as if this is a threatened environment. Worse, the parks as they are now are unusually fine, among the best in the world, and it would be a tragedy to lose them wherever they were. If you accept the logic that they are inappropriate because they are in a European style, then clearly you would have to get rid of all of Adelaide's houses, streets, buildings, and European-derived people. Unfortunately, as so often in a short-sighted world, no one asked me about any of this. Still, the parks remain lovely for the moment, and I was happy to pass into them now. They were packed with large family groups enjoying Australia Day, picnicking and playing cricket with tennis balls. Adelaide has miles of good beaches in its western suburbs, so it surprised me that such numbers of people had forsaken the shore to come into the city. It gave the day an engagingly old-fashioned air. This is how we spent the 4th of July when I was a kid in Iowa, in parks, playing ball games. It seemed odd, too, but again pleasing, that in a country of so much space people chose to crowd together to relax. Perhaps it's all that intimidating emptiness that makes Australians such social creatures. The parks were so crowded, in fact, that it was often impossible to tell which ball game belonged to which group of onlookers, or even sometimes which fielders belonged to which ball game. When a ball bounced into a neighboring party, as seemed to happen quite regularly, there was always an exchange of apologies on the one hand and a call of no worries on the other as the ball was tossed back into play. It was effectively all one very large picnic, and I felt almost ridiculously pleased to be part of it, even in such a marginal way. It took about 3 hours, I suppose, to do the complete circuit of the parks. Quite often a roar would rise from the oval. Cricket was obviously a livelier spectacle in person than on the radio. At length I emerged onto a street called Pennington Terrace, where a row of neat bluestone houses with shady lawns overlooked the oval. At one, a family had essentially moved its living room onto the front lawn. I know it can't have been, but in my recollection they had brought out everything. Floor lamps, coffee table, area rug, magazine basket, coal scuttle. They had certainly brought out a sofa and a television on which they were watching the cricket. Behind the television, a couple of hundred yards away across open parkland, stood the oval, so that whenever anything dramatic happened on their screen, it was accompanied in real time by a roar from the stadium just beyond. "Who's winning?" I called as I walked past. "Bloody palms," the man said, inviting me to share his amazement. I trudged on uphill past the imposing hulk of St. Peter's Cathedral. I was heading in a general way toward my hotel, intending to have a shower and a change of clothes before setting off to look for a pub and dinner. Out of the shade of the parks, it was a blisteringly hot afternoon, and I was by now quite footsore, but I found myself drawn helplessly into the residential streets of North Adelaide. It was an area of quiet prosperity, settled under a Sunday serenity, with street after street of old houses, each buried under roses and frangipani, and every little plot a model of meticulously managed floral abundance. At length I arrived at a place called Wellington Square, an open space overlooked by a pub of venerable aspect. I went straight over. Inside it was gloriously cool and convivial, with gleaming fittings and a lot of polished wood, nothing like the austere pubs of the bush. This was a place for cocktails, for talking about one's investment portfolio. It was busy, too, though most of the customers were eating rather than drinking, or at least eating as well as drinking. At nearly every table they were hunched over steaks, or battered portions of fish so hearty that they hung over the edge of the plates. On a large pull-down screen the cricket was showing, but with the sound turned down. I had found my home for the evening. I ordered a pint of Cooper's Draft and retired with it to a table overlooking the square. And there I sat for a good few minutes doing nothing at all, not even touching my glass, just savoring the pleasure of sitting down and finding myself in a far country with a glass of beer and cricket on the TV and a room full of people enjoying the fruits of a prosperous age. I could not have been happier. After a while, I remembered my purchases from the second-hand bookshop and pulled them out for examination. I turned first to Australian Paradox, an account of a year-long stay in the country in 1959 to 1960, written by an English journalist named Jean Mackenzie, and cracked it open, interested to see how Australia today compared with the Australia of 40 years ago. Well, what a different world it was. The Australia Ms. Mackenzie describes is a place of boundless prosperity, full employment, twinkling wholesomeness, and infinite optimism. In 1959, Australia was the third wealthiest country on the planet. I hadn't realized this, exceeded only by the United States and Canada. But what was particularly interesting was how modest were the components of material well-being back then. With admiration bordering on amazement, Ms. Mackenzie notes that by the end of the 1950s, three-quarters of city dwellers in Australia had a refrigerator, and almost half had a washing machine. There wasn't yet enough electricity in most rural areas to run big appliances, so they didn't count. Nearly every home in the nation, she went on, had at least one radio. Gosh! And most homes have other electrical appliances such as vacuum cleaners, irons, and electric jugs. Oh, to live in a world in which the ownership of an electric jug is a source of pride. I spent a good hour reading through the book at random, spellbound by the simplicity of the age she described. In 1960, television was still an exciting novelty. It didn't reach Australia until 1956, and then only in Sydney and Melbourne at first, colour television a distant dream. In Melbourne on Sundays there were no newspapers, and movie theatres and pubs were shut by law. Perth was still at the end of a very long dirt road, and would remain so for many years. Adelaide was just half the size it is now, and its famous festival was then brand new. Queensland was backward, still is. Even in the best restaurants, chicken Maryland and beef stroganoff were dishes of exotic distinction, and oysters were served with ketchup. For most people, foreign cuisine began and ended with spaghetti out of cans. Cheese came in two varieties, sharp and tasty. Supermarkets were a new and exciting concept. 5% of college-age kids in 1959 were actually in college, this also reported with admiration, up from 1.56% 20 years before. It was, in every way, a different world. What struck me in all this was not how much better off Australians are today, but how much worse they feel. One of the oddest things for an outsider to do is watch Australians assessing themselves. They are an extraordinarily self-critical people. You encounter it constantly in newspapers and on television and radio, a nagging conviction that no matter how good things are in Australia, they are bound to be better elsewhere. A curiously large proportion of books on Australian life and history bear grave, pessimistic titles. Among the Barbarians, The Future Eaters, The Tyranny of Distance, This Tired Brown Land, Fatal Impact, The Fatal Shore. Even when the titles are neutral, they are never positive. They often contain the oddest, most startling conclusions. In A Shorter History of Australia, a thoughtful and unexceptionable survey of the country's considerable achievements over the past 200 years, the author, Geoffrey Blainey, finishes by noting that Australia has nearly completed its first century under peaceful federation. Then, out of the blue, he concludes with these words. Whether it will last for two centuries is not certain. In the sweep of human history, no political boundary is permanent. Now, is that very strange or what? You could understand a Canadian writing those words, or a Belgian or a South African, but an Australian? Please. This is a country that has never had a serious civil disturbance, never jailed a dissident, never showed the tiniest inclination to fray at the edges. Australia is the Norway of the Southern Hemisphere. And yet here is the country's foremost living historian, suggesting that its continuation as a sovereign nation is by no means assured. Extraordinary. If Australians lack one thing in their lonely eminence down under, it is perspective. For four decades they have watched in quiet dismay as one country after another, Switzerland, Sweden, Japan, Kuwait, and many others, has climbed over them on the per capita gross domestic product, or GDP, table. When news came out in 1996 that Hong Kong and Singapore had also squeezed ahead, you'd have thought from the newspaper editorials and analyses that Asian armies had come ashore somewhere around Darwin and were fanning out across the country, appropriating consumer durables as they went. Never mind that most of these countries were only marginally ahead, and that much of it was to do with relative exchange rates. Never mind that when you take into account quality of